Hey everyone, welcome to another episode of the Market Disruptors Show. And today I am joined by Preston Pish. He is the host of one of the bigger podcasts that I've been listening to for a while, the Investors Podcast, studying billionaires for a long time now, diving into Bitcoin. And today we are going to dive into lots of fun stuff, financial stuff, Bitcoin stuff. Should be a pretty good time. Preston, welcome to the show.
Hey, thanks for having me. Love being here, Mark.
Yeah, so I'm so glad we were able to do this. We had a good time doing one together with Swan Bitcoin recently. That was a lot of fun. It seemed like it got a lot of good reviews. And so I wanted to kind of build on top of that. So thanks for that. I said that, you know, you're the host of the Investor Podcast, and I've been listening to that podcast for quite a while. Maybe you want to just give us a little bit of a background on what you're doing, what you're focusing on?
Well, so, you know, we started off the show with a really strong focus on Warren Buffett. Just out of the interest of exploring other investors, because there's all these other investors that have made tons of money in the market. Stig and I just were like, all right, well, let's start studying some of these other folks. Like, how does this guy do? Like, a perfect example when I think about something that's very different to Warren Buffett is like George Soros or Stan Druckenmiller and how they invest through momentum. And when you really start to study one person in particular and you buy into the dogma, I'll call it, of how they invest, it sometimes is uncomfortable to kind of study other ways that people are doing it, because some of it just doesn't necessarily go hand in hand, or at least you don't think that it does. And so as we were doing the show, it was really fun to try to learn how these other people were doing investing, because it challenged our own core beliefs and made us really try it. I feel like it rounded me out. Now, you know, people will maybe disagree or agree or whatever. Studying people like Ray Dalio, he has this different approach. He got into this whole thing called risk parity, which I can talk in a lot of detail if people have interest in it. But, you know, we started off just kind of real narrow. It kept expanding. And as we were studying all these new people, you're just like, wow, this world is way bigger and way more complex than you might think at face value. And there's people that have made billions for decades implementing approaches that are just slightly different or completely different than what you might originally think is the only way that works.
Yeah. So. Yeah, I love that, because I've really built my career, business and investing wise, off of kind of a similar concept, which is success leaves clues. And so, right, you find someone else successful, you find out what those steps they did, you try to duplicate those things and hopefully have about the same results. And so, yeah, everything I've done in business and investing, I've always tried to do that. And so that's really cool that's kind of how you've been doing that. So as you've been studying these different people, I'm sure seeing the evolution of finance, which I want to talk about. Hey, just a real quick interruption to let you know that this video is brought to you ad-free by BlockFi. Now, they're giving you the ability to HODL your Bitcoin and your crypto as it goes up in value. And at the same time, you can earn high yielding interest on it. So you can basically hold it for all the upside potential, and then you can make cash flow off of it at the exact same time. Now, opening an account super fast, super simple, and they've offered to give me up to $250 for every sign up. But I told them, you know what, let's give it back to you. So you can now go and you can get the $250 whenever you set up your account. And all you have to do is just check the link in the description for details, set up an account super quick and easy, and earn up to $250, brought to you by BlockFi. So check them out.
I was going to ask you a question. I don't want to jump too far ahead into Bitcoin, but I was curious. Let's talk about that first. So what have you seen, you know, studying these investors? Obviously Warren Buffett, right? He's Uncle Warren, right? He's been doing it for a long time. You mentioned Soros and Druckenmiller, kind of the same camp. Then now things are a lot different today. And it seems like some of the old guys like Buffett really aren't keeping up with the times a little bit. Just finance has changed overall. What have you seen in that evolution, or what have you seen between these successful people?
Well, I would just say in general, I think if you look at what's happened over the last 10 years specifically and how that's impacted a lot of their investing approaches. I mean, the thing we're here that both of us have a real common interest in is Bitcoin. And the reason why is because it's a change in how currency is being looked at. And so when you look at their approaches, Buffett is very micro focused. So he's looking at the companies. He has been on record for decades saying, if the chairman of the Federal Reserve came up to me and told me what they were going to do as far as moving interest rates, it just wouldn't concern me in the least bit. And so to this day, I think if you asked him that, he would tell you to this day that he still does not care what the central banks or what the chairman of the Federal Reserve or any other central bank is going to do, because he's looking at businesses and he's looking at businesses that are profitable.
Right.
So is that approach still valid today? I would kind of push back on that.
Right.
At least for the last 10 years, because when you start getting into how manipulated the markets are, value investing has significantly underperformed momentum investing, which is more the Soros, Druckenmiller style of investing.
Yep.
Now, if I was going to stand up for Warren, I think he has performed exemplary over the last 10 years, considering the circumstances. Because if you're looking at value only funds like ETFs and stuff, they've been crushed. Mm-hmm. But if you look at Berkshire Hathaway and how it stood up, if you go to the market bottom until today, it has done extremely well as far as keeping pace with the S&P 500, and maybe not so much the NASDAQ, but the S&P 500, he has done really well at sustaining the growth rate of his company relative to that, even though he's executing a value investing strategy.
Yeah. Yeah, that I would say, you know, I've studied both of them, not probably near the depth that you have, but the comment you made about Buffett, even if the Fed whispered in his ear, right, he wouldn't jump on that. Whereas I've studied Druckenmiller, and that's what he lived off of, right?
That's the thing that he holistically pays attention. So isn't that amazing that you see two guys that have decades and decades of performance to back up their decision-making that validates their decision-making?
Yeah.
And literally the polar opposite approach, where I would tell you Druckenmiller, like you said, is hyper-focused on anything that the central bankers are doing. Yep. And his entire philosophy of where he's going to try to invest is like, that's the root of where he's going, where Warren is looking straight to the free cash flows. That's the thing. And the competitive advantage of the business. Those two things are really where he's hyper-focused.
So if I'm looking at the investing world and how things have changed, what it seems to me, and it seems where Buffett has kind of lost a little bit of an edge, where Druckenmiller's can maintain the edge, is that today businesses don't seem to be in the business of making profits or making money anymore. It seems like businesses today are in the business of raising money, maybe pushing revenue. Yes.
Totally. So, you know, when you debase the money the way that you're debasing it, the name of the game is, how can I get this off of my balance sheet and exchange it for something that has a lot of growth to it, or something that's going to be able to outpace this significant amount of debasement? Now, whether people are doing that via calculation or they're just doing it via intuition, it doesn't really much matter, because that's what at the end of the day, that's the decision-making that they are making based on what we've seen over the last 10 years. And when we look at debasement rates, I mean, everyone knows I've been throwing around the term, Michael Saylor's been throwing around, Lynn Alden's been throwing around, that, you know, M2 debasement is pretty much what we think the inflation rate really is. Now, you're going to get a lot of people that, especially people on Wall Street, that'll argue that. You'll definitely have fixed income people that'll argue that, because boy, that wouldn't look good if they were buying things with 1 or 2% yield and the real debasement rates, you know, inflation rates, 15%.
Right.
So, I mean, it really comes down to how you're seeing things, but I think that your comment that the incentive structure is for you to invest in something that can outpace that or has a growth rate of users that are being onboarded with a very low expense structure relative to how many people you're able to reach out and grab on a global scale digitally. That's been the trade, and that's been the winner of the last decade. So,
yeah.
And I expect it to continue until hard money reappears, or at least the majority of the market participants see hard money reappearing.
Yeah, which we're definitely going to talk about. But to that point, looking at M2 and looking at the rate of that growth, you know, it's 15% or whatever that is. it goes into different areas. And I know one, you know, obviously the government uses CPI, right? Consumer Price Index, to measure that inflation. And it seems like they've changed the way they do that so many times, the 80s, the 90s. I mean, it's constantly being changed. We have, you know, other sources, Shadow Stats or, you know, Chapwood Index or something like that, which I think gives a more accurate picture, and it shows 10 to 12%. But do you think that inflation is more of a nuanced argument, right? Where it's like things that I might buy are priced differently. I mean, obviously we've seen massive inflation in certain assets like beachfront property or collectible items and things like that versus other items. Is it a little bit more nuanced today than most people want to make it believe like it is?
Let me think of an example that would describe my thoughts on quote unquote inflation. It's almost like, it'd almost be like somebody saying, hey, if it's got a cell, well, then it's a life form. It's so generic that people could look at that and be like, are they talking about a human being? Are they talking about mammals? Are they talking about,
right?
Are they talking about, you know, I mean, the list could go on, because when you think about biology, it's just got so much breadth. And so when I think about how you can apply such a generic term like inflation to everybody's preconceived labeling that they have on a subconscious level of what that means to them. And, you know, when I think of inflation, I think of debasement.
Mm-hmm.
The money that, or excuse me, the currency that I'm using is getting debased.
Right.
And what do I got to do in terms of owning certain things in order to protect my buying power inside of this ecosystem of currency that's being used? That's how I look at inflation. And that's how I would look at it from a terminology standpoint and a labeling standpoint, because anything that you own that's not keeping up with that debasement rate, you're losing buying power.
Yeah.
That's just, there's no arguing or refuting that. So,
and I think that's the key term is buying power. I say purchasing power, but the same thing. And so that's what I try to tell people, like, you got to focus. What's really happening is you're losing purchasing power, right? You're not buying as much. And so the key is to retain purchasing power or increase purchasing power. And so trying to find those assets that do that. So
Mark, if you're using a sound money, sorry to interrupt, if you're using a sound money and you're used to using a sound money that's not being debased in a way that is really that meaningful, or something that you just kind of, like if you go back in time and you would look at what would be a good period to use. I think the 90s, when the debasement rate really wasn't nearly as high as it is now, or you'd go back into like the 50s, where the debasement rate wasn't anything like it is now. You go into the early 80s, it was really showing up in the CPI gauge. And that's why, like you were saying earlier, they kept adjusting it. So at these various points in time, it's a lot easier for people to just ignore this and just do economic calculation like they normally would, the textbook way of doing discount cash flows and things like that, in order to come up with valuations. But when you get in these situations where you go in from the 70s into the 80s, really noticeable that there's an issue with the money supply. Obviously, we come off the gold standard through that period of time, and we make this transition into this floating currency. Now, I would argue we're in another situation where all those same things are rearing their heads again. And you know, you go back to that period of time, Warren Buffett was writing a lot about, you know, how do I protect, how do I deal with this hurdle rate of 15% on the 10-year treasury when the money is being debased so quickly? And he writes about this extensively. One of the neat things that he talked about during that period of time was intangible assets versus tangible assets. And this, I mean, you could go back and read the shareholder letters. It's quite fascinating to hear his discussion points on this. And his big point was, is if you have a balance sheet that has a lot of tangible assets, it's really hard to keep up with the repricing of those as you have such a high debasement rate. Mm-hmm. And if you look at intangible assets, call it through brand power or whatever, think of it like this. If you have a product on Amazon and you have almost no, it's a digital asset, call it a digital course that you're selling. You can reprice that by the day because it's intangible. Mm-hmm. But if it was a tangible book and you had 10,000 in inventory on Amazon and you sell only 100 a month and the inflation is going up, like it's a little bit harder to manage the cost that you paid for those 10,000 books up front to go through the inflation piece. So I find it really interesting that all the things that we're seeing right now are so similar to back then when he was talking about these things in shareholder letters, which a lot of people aren't going to go back and read shareholder letters from the 1980s. I think he was talking about that like in the early 1980 shareholder letters, but it's all valid stuff that applies today. So if you've got a business, you should be trying to create assets that are intangible because your ability to reprice them during debasement is much more favorable than trying to do it with tangible assets.
And when you say tangible assets, you're talking about real things. So commodities, gold, silver, things that can't be debased. So
specifically, I think in if I'm comparing it to the way Warren was describing it in his shareholder letters, he's looking at it as inventory churn. And he's looking at it from anything that you have to hold as a business, tangible item, you know, like let's say you got some type of metal cabling or whatever. If you have a large bin in order to hold all of that, and you've built this infrastructure to hold all these coils or whatever, if the money's not getting debased, well, you can take advantage of all that CapEx of your building and your infrastructure. But if it's getting debased at a breakneck pace, you don't want to fill up that huge warehouse that you've got because you don't want to take that on because the cost of securing it and then selling it going into, you know, the next month, it's getting eroded rapidly. So now a company that had prepared themselves for these kind of things, they're sitting on this massive amount of infrastructure. Think about what's happening today right now. I mean, all this stuff that he was talking about is valid today. All this commercial real estate, right? All that kind of stuff. That's all that CapEx that these companies are paying to sustain and manage. But yet in a rapidly debasement type currency world, that becomes a massive expense and a massive frictional drag to the business in order to keep pace with the debasement. And so if you're a business that has a lot of intangible assets, this is really important. When I stood up my company, I had read these shareholder letters before I even, you know, turned my company into an LLC. And I learned very early on that if I was creating assets, I probably wanted to do it as in a manner that involved mostly intangible assets, if possible. Mm-hmm. So it was a really important read for me foundationally very early on reading those shareholder letters. And it's coming very useful as we look at what's happening today and how much the money's, the currency's being debased.
You've really set the problem up pretty well. And I think it only gets exaggerated because we have no schedule or no idea or view into how much worse or how much faster it can go, right? It's like almost like, I feel like we can understand natural market moves, which, but today it's not about natural market. It's about the 7 Fed bankers or 12 guys in a room and like what's in their head, what are they going to do? Right. Like, and we have no idea what they're going to do. So then how do we plan for that? We can't, I guess.
Well, and I think the other thing that I would highlight is what everybody was experiencing back in the 70s and 80s was the transition point. It wasn't the default wasn't actualized back then, even though that's what was playing out. So when you come off the gold standard, it's a default at that point. But the default wasn't realized because everything continued to press forward globally and everything appeared to be somewhat normal. It felt like everything was normalized, even though there was this big major event that took place where pretty much the entire world came off the gold standard at the same time in 70, because everyone was pegged to the dollar. So now we are at the realization point of those past decisions. Mm-hmm. Everything that led up to that event in 71, which played out from the 1940s up until that point, all those decisions that led up to that is actually getting realized right now. And so I think that this is going to be such a bigger event than anything they saw back in the 70s and 80s, because the debt it's going to be impaired. Eventually, I have no idea when, but there's going to come a point where fixed income investors are going to look at this and say the debasement rate is nowhere near CPI, not even in the same universe of CPI. Yeah. And it's going to be a massive, massive event when it's eventually realized.
Yeah, it seems like we know what's inevitable. We know what's going to happen. Obviously, trying to figure out when makes it impossible. But we can see that we're on an unsustainable path. I mean, just look at the central bankers, right? They have really two tools at their disposal, interest rates and debt. And we're kind of out of interest rates. And we have so much debt. How much more can we take? Like, they're almost running out of tools, it seems like. And we hear talk of, you know, the Great Reset, whatever that's going to mean. We can see that they're trying to actively change the financial system, right? Whether they're trying to change from the LIBOR to the SOFR indexes, they're trying to change the currencies, trying to get current, like central bank digital currency set up to like make this transition. So it's almost like they're almost like just trying to keep it going until they're ready to make the switch. And then it might come fast and swift. Do you have any thoughts on that?
Well, so they're going to try anything and everything to keep things quote unquote normalized, to keep the semblance of stability in place.
But until they're ready to make a switch, or they're going to try to keep it normalized forever.
And I think that's why the market, they're not going to be able to do this forever.
Well, so, not that they're going to be able to, but you think they're going to continue to try, or they're trying to keep it going until they're ready to make a switch.
I think they're going to continue to try. And I think the reason you're not seeing people that are buying fixed income corporate, I mean, they're stepping in and buying that market. They're being incentivized. People that are owners of this stuff are being incentivized to get more, because the governments around the world have demonstrated that if people start selling off or get spooked, they'll step in and provide a backstop and limit the amount of selling that can take place. So as a person that would own something like that, you get comfortable when thinking, hey, the government's got my back. There's no other currency in the world to run to, is the mindset today. Mm-mm. So why wouldn't I keep participating in this charade? And where I think it all kind of comes unglued is no one sees that other alternative today. Most market participants don't see an alternative to the currencies that exist. So they're saying, well, you know, if things get really bad, they're just going to reset. Everyone will go back on a gold standard and they'll have central bank digital currencies. The problem with that narrative is that at the root of the issue we've got is fiscal spending. Mm-hmm. And so when you look at the direction of where that's going, it's not just going higher. It's rapidly accelerating in a direction where people are voting for even further and further fiscal spending because they want it into their pocket. They want their money now. And as long as you have that habit, that cognitive, collective, global habit of people saying the government owes me a check.
Right.
As long as that's in place, I don't care what you peg it with, the currency that they create. I don't care what you peg it to. You're going to have to come off that peg almost immediately.
Yep.
So when you look at Bretton Woods to 1971, they went, three decades of it remaining pegged, that the basement was slow enough that it lasted 3 decades. If they did it today, it might not even last a year before everyone's saying, there's no way they can make good on this.
Yep.
There's just no way.
So, I mean, that definitely sets the stage. And so it's a good transition. So as you just said, right, like most market participants don't see the option to get out of that. And obviously that's what brought us here together to talk about this. And so the option that we see is Bitcoin. And so I know, depending on, you know, whoever's listening to this, there's different levels of people, but I recently heard you talking about something that's really been happening and how right now 2020, 2021 is a lot different than back in like 2017. And you were talking about like the level of entrenchment that's coming into Bitcoin. I think that's the word that you used. So it's like, not everybody knows about this, but it seems like it's catching on pretty big. And at this point, we're even seeing some of the big financial players, even some of the government people starting to get involved. So do you think they're starting to like see the need enough where they're starting to explore that more?
Yeah, I think they're seeing the need. And I think they're also seeing the opportunity cost of not playing the game.
Mm-hmm.
Because especially in the world of finance, if you openly step out and say, yeah, I don't want anything to do with that, that probably means you're taking a position. That's just part of the culture of finance is, and so I think there's a lot of distrust between each other, between the participants, because anyone who looks at this and quickly understands what this is, realizes that if you aren't taking even a small position, and others continue to participate, you're the sucker at the table. Mm-hmm. It's the prisoner's dilemma, but it's between nation states is really what we're talking about, is the ultimate prisoner's dilemma between nation states.
Yeah. Well, that's the game theory.
And that's the game theory.
Yeah.
And I think you have enough people here in the US, over in the UK, Singapore, I mean, Germany, people know what this has the capability or the potential to turn into. So if you're doing things to limit that and others aren't, boy, oh boy, the writing's on the wall that you're going to get left in the dust.
Yeah.
And I don't think anybody wants to be left in the dust at this point.
Well, I would hope not. It seems like the US, you know, the Federal Reserve has the most to lose, seen as the dollar is still the reserve currency. So other countries might be more willing to adopt it, but I could see the US wanting to be kind of the last person to jump in there. And we're seeing some mixed messages. So we have, you know, SEC, the new SEC incoming chair, Gary Gensler, it seems to be pro Bitcoin. I know you've talked about him teaching at MIT about Bitcoin. We have, Larry Summers. He was talking about how Bitcoin is here to stay. And so we have like some of these government people that seem very pro. Then we have like Janet Yellen now talking about how it needs to be either stopped or shut down because it's, you know, nefarious actors. We have Christine Lagarde, who's not part of the US, but part of the ECB, talking about it as well. So we kind of have this mixed message there. How does that get reconciled?
Well, when you hear their Lagarde and Yellen's comments, they're specifically saying that the use of it being used as payments for nefarious activities needs to be stopped. They're not saying that Bitcoin, the protocol, needs to be shut down. And I think even if they would say that, I think it would get some chuckles out of people that understand how it actually works. Mm-hmm. So their comments to me seem to be aligned with what any policy maker would say for some type of loophole for nefarious activity for payments. Maybe I'm just looking at it too literal. Maybe I'm not. I don't know, but that's how at least I'm interpreting it. And okay. I think if I was going to say one more thing about it, I would say that they're in the business of stability. That's the thing that they really are focused on. And so does Janet Yellen. Let me give you two examples. Janet Yellen goes out and says, Bitcoin's going to change the world. And we're looking into it extensively. I just don't think that would be a really calming event for the market. I think that would be something that would set it ablaze.
Right.
And it would lead to instability.
It'd be good for the small amount of Bitcoiners. It'd be bad for everybody else.
Now, if she comes out and says kind of like what she said, everyone's like, oh, well, they're going to ban it. Everyone's got their opinion on their interpretation of what she said. And I just think that it's much more, it's a stabilizing comment for the market at whole in the way that she views it, $100 trillion plus debt market, all these kind of things. Like that's how she's viewing the quote unquote economy. Mm. And so she's saying whatever she can, the forward guidance is the big, you know, buzzword that they use. When you look at how they've been using forward guidance for the last decade, it's always been in a manner to try to provide as much stability moving forward as possible, irregardless of whether it's good long-term for the market or not.
Yeah. I remember a couple of years ago hearing Christine Lagarde talk, I think when she was still at the IMF, and she was talking about how even like financial innovation, I think specifically she was talking about cryptocurrencies, maybe it was 2017, and she was saying it's a threat to the stability of the financial system. And like she was saying, we don't want innovation because it would disrupt the system. But I guess when I listen to myself say that through the lens that you just provided, I guess it does make a little bit more sense.
I think they get it. I really do. I think if you would sit down with them in a private room and say, none of this can go on the record, and you were able to, and you were able to extract what they really think.
Yeah.
I really think they get it. I think they know where this is going. Now I might be giving them too much credit. I don't know, but you know, Gary Gensler is a perfect example. Watch his free 24 lesson course. Each lesson's an hour long. If you don't think that guy doesn't know what's happening, you're out of your mind. And so these people are in government, and like him, I mean, he's going to be the new SEC chairman, taught the course at MIT on this topic in depth. I guarantee you, you could probably put him up against any person in Bitcoin, and he knows it just as well as them.
Yeah.
Maybe even better.
Yeah.
So they're there, they're informing, they're having these conversations with these people. And here's some.
Hey, just another quick interruption to let you know that this video is brought to you ad-free by BlockFi. Now, they allow you to hold onto your Bitcoin and your other cryptos for all the potential upside. And at the same time, you can earn high yielding interest on it. So it basically cash flows. Now with BlockFi, you can earn up to 8.6% interest. You can also borrow against your crypto as well. It's super fast. It's super easy to set up an account. And right now, you can get up to $250 when you set up your account. Check the link in the description that I have for details in order to claim that $250, because BlockFi is the future of finance. Just check the link in the description for all the details of how to claim your $250 today.
Something to think about. If you're Gary Gensler and you know as much as you know, do you really think he doesn't have a personal position?
Yeah.
I mean, even a small personal position.
Yeah.
So if he's now advising on the direction of this stuff, do you not think that there's, and I'm going to use the word conflict of interest, but, and it might not be the right word, but if he's advising somebody on the future of this stuff, you cannot tell me that he is not more favorable to something that he would own personally in his own account than trying to ban it and prevent it from happening. Now think about how many other, and Larry Summers, I mean, you watch that video of him. I am not a fan of this guy.
Right.
But you watch the video of him talking about it. And when I posted the video, somebody wrote, "Sure sounds like a whole coiner to me." And I just laughed out loud because I thought the exact same thing when I watched the video. Like, you can't tell me this guy doesn't have this in his portfolio. You're out of your mind. So how's he advising people?
Yeah. Yeah. Good point. I think, you know, as far as a conflict of interest, I mean, everybody has a conflict, right?
And that's so, right.
I remember whoever that last Supreme Court justice was that got elected by Trump. I forget what her name was, but you know, oh, she has a conflict of interest because she's a mother of seven kids and she's a Catholic. And it's like, well, if she wasn't a Catholic, then she'd have a different conflict. Like, it's like everyone's got some
I don't bias. Like the term that I use, to be honest with
you.
But it's a term everyone knows.
I get what you're saying.
Yeah.
So so we've kind of set the stage. We got the problem. We got a solution. We have one of the biggest objections that I hear all the time is that the government's going to ban it. And so that's why I kind of wanted to tackle that. We have some really big news around it, which of course we just talked about. But it seems like no matter how much advancement we make, no matter how much entrenchment, your word, we have coming into the system, yet there's still the FUD, right? The fear, uncertainty, and doubt, almost like these bombs that like get picked up. So we have a couple I want to just jump into. So we have like the Tether FUD. That's probably been the biggest one that's been going around. And I can't even count how many messages I must have got asking my opinion on that. I'm sure you did as well.
Yeah, definitely.
I'm curious what you think about that. I mean, is it like some sort of bias? Like these people are mad they didn't buy it. I'm curious what people are really afraid of. Like, I mean, are they not gonna be able to redeem their Tether for a dollar? Like, what does that matter to the Bitcoin? Or is it because you think Tether was artificially pumping Bitcoin, and if it disappears, then the pump will be gone? What's your thought on that whole Tether FUD?
So my first question would be, why do they only decide to pump it every 4 years? There's no way that you're gonna be able to step into that discussion with any type of conclusion or any type of conclusive evidence. You know, I listened to Peter McCormick's discussion with the CEO of the company. And, you know, I try to listen for cues of like, does it seem like this person's telling the truth? You know, and you can get, everyone can draw their different conclusions. I'm sure you could talk to 10 different people. Mm-hmm. Four of them would tell you that guy is a total liar. Six of them might tell you, I believe him, or vice versa or whatever. But until you can audit the books, there's no way to prove whether it's a valid concern or not. So instead of trying to debate whether I think it's real or not, which I can't prove either way, mm-hmm. I'm more looking at it. Well, what would be the impact to Bitcoin? Because right. That's the thing that I own. I've never owned a Tether in my life, ever. Right. So I'm looking at it purely from how does this impact the immutable decentralized protocol that we know Bitcoin today? How does it impact it? I think that my personal opinion is that let's go through the scenario that it's a total scam. So in this scenario, I would suspect that it would cause a short-term drop in the price of Bitcoin just because a lot of people that own Bitcoin, a significant portion of people that own Bitcoin, are going to get scared by that event. They're going to somehow say, well, if that's a scam, well, everything else could be a scam. And they're going to sell their positions. And you're going to, my opinion is you'll have a bunch of strong hands that step into the market and quickly suck all that selling up.
Right.
So I look at it more as a buying opportunity. If for whatever reason it is a scam, which I don't think that it is, and most of the reason I would tell you I don't think that it is comes down to this isn't the first time we've heard this. This isn't the first time this narrative is
definitely not.
2017, my God, that's all you heard probably in like the November timeframe of 2017. I remember this distinctly of everybody saying, oh my God, this thing's getting totally pumped by Tether. This is a total scam.
Yeah.
And the price, you know, we went into 2018 and the price started going down. Price went down 80%. And
why didn't they pump it?
Yeah. There's Tether's still there.
Yeah.
If they were a fractional reserve, you know, my experience with Ponzi schemes, not that I have any experience, but anything that I've seen blow up in the past is that when it's a Ponzi scheme and it's a fractional reserve system that you can't print the money, that you've got to have some type of real dollars behind it whenever everyone's, you know, turning it in and wanting dollars in return, when the price goes down 80%, it blows up.
Right.
And we didn't see that. And that doesn't mean that it's not a scam, but it's just, for me, it's another data point that says, I don't think that there's much significance to this. So why spread this narrative, which is your original question? And in my opinion, in my very humble opinion, it's people that are entering for the first time. They weren't in the 2017 timeframe. They're entering right now for the first time. And maybe they didn't have a very big position. Maybe they sold at 42,000, right? As the price went up there. Mm-hmm. And they're desperately trying to justify their action. Because if the price recovers and it starts going to 50 or 60, that would be a very painful pill for a lot of them to swallow.
Yeah.
So I suspect you've had some people that have taken some money off the table because they had a big fat gain over the last 12 months. And they're desperately searching for justification to confirm that what they did was right. And
And I think a lot of those weak hands that have come in, weak hands have come into the market, they're skittish. You know, they know that Bitcoin's volatile. They know it could drop at any time. You and I, people like us, we tell them it can drop at any time. And so any piece of news, it's that confirmation bias. So they have that bias. They're afraid. They get a little confirmation and maybe they jump on it.
I'm looking at this drop we've got right now, and the price is 29,900 right now. And it went up to 42,000 and it's had this pretty big drop. I don't know what that is in percent terms, but here I'll say what it is. So we've had a 28% drop. When I see this type of thing, I ask myself, so what has fundamentally changed about the protocol? Has there been an update? Has there been some type of major restriction by a big country? And the answer to the question is nothing has changed.
Nope.
Other than the fact that the price was outstripping and going faster than the stock to flow model. That was something that was happening and being a correction back down to what it, you know,
I think it was the triple threat combo. It was like Janet Yellen coming out. It was the Tether FUD. And then we had the double spend, and it's like three things and everyone's just panicking, I guess.
Yeah. And you know what? It's going to continue to do this until this bull market, you know, fizzles out, or maybe even just keeps on going. I don't know, but you've got to expect a lot of volatility along the way. And yeah,
to
hasn't
add to that,
my opinion.
To add to that point, though, I mean, you're right. You know, 2017, we heard this all the time. But in 2017, Tether was the stable coin, right? So it was like it had such a big percentage of the market share, where today we have so many different stable coins. So even if Tether were to go down, it's such a smaller piece of the overall market that I just don't see it.
I love where you're going with that, because there's so many other, it seems to me like every exchange is trying to stand up their own stable coin in order to have their own personal network effect and capture some of that value that they've obviously had a first mover advantage for. I mean, look at Gemini, look at Kraken, and look at Coinbase. I would tell you, I think a lot of the big boomer banks that you know everyone knows on Wall Street, they're all trying to get in this business too. So it's a total rat race of everybody trying to create a stable coin. And you know, if the market was really concerned about what was happening over at Tether, you would see their market share. You would see exchanges offboarding Tether and onboarding something else aggressively.
Yeah.
And you're not seeing anything of the sort. So that makes you wonder, like, so there's nobody in the know, there's nobody talking or concerned about this. Evidently not. The people that are closest to it sure aren't concerned about it.
Yeah. Yeah. I agree with all that. I just think it seems to me, it's like, if you're afraid you're not going to get your money back out, your dollars that you have in Tether, then that's compartmentalized to Tether. I guess if you think that Bitcoin is only reaching the level because it's being pumped, I think that's totally invalidated. And I guess maybe that's a little bit of risk, but yeah, so we'll go from there. But I know we're running short on time here, so I want to try to wind it down. I had a bunch of questions posed to me on Twitter. I grabbed a couple of them. See if we can get through these here pretty quickly. What do you think about Yellen's 50-year bond idea?
I think it was very inevitable. And, you know, when I saw the announcement, I was like, well, duh. Like, of course, I was surprised it wasn't 100-year.
Yeah.
And I guess you start with
50 and
move to 75 or 100. But yeah. Oh, it's coming.
Yeah.
Don't think for a second that that's not coming. It's just a matter of when. And I mean, there's a question that somebody posed. It was something like this: what's the average duration or time period from the time that a country issues a 100-year or a 50-year bond to the time that they default on their currency or that their currency goes up in flames? Yeah. And I think that that's just such a great question, because it encapsulates everything you need to know about a 50 or 100-year issuance. Is that it's desperation by the issuer. And I mean, look at the yield. Like you really think, as a person buying the other end of that, that if it comes out, let's say it comes out at 4%, the coupon on it, do you really think you can forecast a 4% coupon for the next 50 years from a risk standpoint? It's totally ludicrous.
It's insane.
Insane.
It's insane. I mean, well, yeah. I mean, nobody's going to buy that bond, right? Only the government's going to buy that bond with fake money.
Well, they'll force, yeah, through regulation, they'll force the banks to do it, and then they'll just buy it back from the banks at some point through QE.
Yeah. This is, maybe you want to answer this one. You talked about earlier about when you were talking about the debasement of the currency, tangible assets. Do you hold any other assets besides Bitcoin? Do you like tangible assets, commodities, gold, anything other than Bitcoin?
So, and I have a business, and the business has a bunch of intangible assets. I mean, right now, you and I are creating an intangible asset that you can run advertising on into perpetuity. Right. So when I think of my position size, I look at it very similar to the way that Michael Saylor looks at things. He has a business that's kicking off free cash flows. He's taking his retained earnings and he's investing in something that he has a very high conviction of that is going to protect him against debasement. That's how I look at things. So when I think of it in terms of percentages, that's a very Wall Street-y kind of like question, because that's how most people, when you listen to an investment show, it's all people that manage other people's money, or at least that's what they're used to doing, and that's how they think. But as a business owner, that's not how I think. I think, well, what would be the capitalization of all the assets that I own from a business standpoint that kicks off free cash flows? And then what's the valuation on the things that I've retained and put them in there? And then we can talk percentages, but unfortunately, I have a private company and I have no idea. I mean, I know what I would sell it for and it'd be way higher than what, you know, I suspect I'd be offered to in the market for those assets. So, you know, it turns into, I know it's going to sound, maybe I am sidestepping the question, but I'll put it this way. The way that I structure and the way that I think about things are very, very similar to the way that you've seen happen with a public company in MicroStrategy. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Well, that's a great point though, because I deal with this all the time where I see all these people wanting to come in and be investors. And most people think they can quit their job and become these full-time investors. And I'm like, that's not how this works. Even professional investors, I mean, maybe a couple of these hedge fund guys, but even that's like a job, right? So most people are still working. They still have income from working and then they're investing on the side. So it does make sense to me. Hopefully it makes sense to everybody listening. So you have your business, that's your asset. You're actively working, you have active income, you have tangible assets in that business. And usually the best investment you can make is in your own business anyway. All right, two more. You talked about the Mayer multiple before. What do you think about the Mayer multiple for this bull market?
So I think, and maybe this correction that we're seeing right now is a perfect example of how the Mayer multiple is maybe still valid, because in the back testing, and just so if people see this and they go to the page that lays out some of the statistics that I did in 2017, I haven't touched it since. The statistics were showing that in the way that I back tested, I said, if I bought every single day since the time that Bitcoin was on the open market for buying, and if I bought every single day, when would it be a bad time to buy? And what came back in that scenario was that at a Mayer multiple of 2.4, it was a good indicator of not buying and waiting for the price to drop back below a 2.4, then you would start buying again on it. I think I ran it on a daily basis. If you were able to dollar cost average on a daily basis. So if you're doing it on a monthly basis, maybe your numbers are different. I don't know. But what's interesting is the price on this recent pump that we had here at the start of 2021, it got over that 2.4 threshold for a couple days, I'd say 3 or 4 days. And, you know, and sure enough, that was overbought. And there's been a correction. So that was an interesting. Now, right now, the multiple's back below that threshold, which would suggest that you should be continuing to dollar cost average on a daily basis. So I just found that a little interesting that indicator was suggesting, hey, this has gotten a little overheated. Now, my concern with this multiple on this particular bull run is, let's say that we do go into a scenario where you have hyper Bitcoinization at the end of this, or you know, through 2021 into 2022, whatever. That multiple would have suggested that you step out of the market and that you stop buying. And it might be happening at a point where where that scenario isn't a good recommendation. So that's the only thing that I would caution people with it, and why I don't really particularly put a lot of weight on it. But you know, it's there. You can look at it and come up with whatever risk assumptions you want to make.
Yeah. Okay, good. All right. Well, we'll go ahead and wrap it up with that. I know we're going long and you got to get going. So with that, I guess we'll go ahead and sign it off. But I just want to give you a chance just to let people know where to follow you. I mentioned your podcast. I think you're pretty active on Twitter. Maybe go ahead and drop some names there.
Yeah, that's probably the best place, Mark, is just on Twitter. I like to engage with the audience. And anyone that's got questions, yeah, just hit me up on Twitter. And if you want to check out the podcast, you know,
The Investor Podcast. We'll make sure to link to it down below. And with that, we'll go ahead and sign off, Preston. I appreciate you taking the time to come hang out. It was a fun time.
Mark, I really appreciate this. We got to do it again sometime soon.
Okay. See ya.